Anyway, English was the ship's lingua franca, and at first Maya had thought that this gave the Americans an advantage. But then she noticed that when they spoke, they were always on stage to everyone, while the rest of them had more private languages they could switch to if they wanted. Frank Chalmers was the exception to all that, however. He spoke 5 languages, more than anyone else aboard, and he didn't fear to use his Russian, even though it was very bad. He just hacked out questions and then listened to the answers with a really piercing intensity and a quick, startling laugh. He was an unusual American in many ways, Maya thought. At first, he seemed to have all the characteristics. He was big, loud, maniacally energetic, confident, restless. Talkative and friendly enough after that first coffee. It took a while to notice how he turned the friendliness on and off, and to notice how little his talk revealed. Maya never learned a thing about his past, for instance, despite deliberate efforts to chat him up. It made her curious. He had black hair, a swarthy face, light hazel eyes, handsome in a tough guy way. His smile brief, his laugh sharp, like Maya's mother's. His gaze, too, was sharp, especially when looking at Maya. A matter of evaluating the other leader, she assumed. He acted toward her as if they had an understanding built on long acquaintance, a presumption which made her uneasy, given how little they had spoken together in Antarctica. She was used to thinking of women as her allies, and of men as attractive but dangerous problems. So a man who presumed to be her ally was only the more problematic, and dangerous, and something else. She recalled only one moment when she had seen further into him than the skin, and that had been back in Antarctica. After the thermal engineer had cracked and been sent north, news of his replacement had come down, and when it was announced, everyone was quite surprised and excited to hear that it was going to be John Boone himself, even though he had certainly received more than the maximum radiation dosage on his previous expedition. While the evening room was still buzzing with the news, Maya had seen Chalmers come in and be told of it, and he had jerked his head around to stare at his informant. And then, for a fraction of a second, she had seen a flash of fury, a flash so fast it was almost a subliminal event. But it had made her attentive to him, and certainly he and John Boone had an odd relationship. It was difficult for Chalmers, of course. He was the Americans' official leader, and even had the title captain. But Boone, with his blonde good looks and the strange presence of his accomplishment, certainly had more natural authority. He seemed the real American leader, and Frank Chalmers something like an overactive executive officer doing Boone's unspoken bidding. That could not be comfortable. They were old friends, Maya had been told when she asked, but she saw few signs of it herself, even watching closely. They seldom talked to each other in public and didn't seem to visit in private. Thus, when they were together, she watched them more closely than ever, without ever consciously considering why. The natural logic of the situation just seemed to demand it. If they had been back at Glove Cosmos, it would have made strategic sense to drive a wedge between them. But she didn't think of it that way here. There was a lot that Maya didn't think about consciously. She watched, though. And one morning, Janet Blylevin wore her video glasses into D Hall for breakfast. She was a principal reporter for American television, and often she wove her way through the ship wearing her vid glasses, looking around and talking the commentary, collecting stories and transmitting them back home where they would be, as Arcadi put it, pre-digested and vomited back into that baby bird consensus. It was nothing new, of course. Media attention was a familiar part of every astronaut's life, and during the selection process they had been scrutinized more than ever. Now, however, they were the raw material for programs magnitudes more popular than any space program had been before. Millions watched them as the ultimate soap opera, and this bothered some of them. So when Janet settled at the end of the table wearing those stylish spectacles with the optical fibers in the frame, there were a few groans. And at the other end of the table, Anne Claiborne and Sax Russell were arguing. oblivious to any of them. "It'll take years to find out what we have there, Sax. Decades. There's as much land on Mars as on Earth, with a unique geology and chemistry. The land has to be thoroughly studied before we can start changing it."
"We'll change it just by landing."
Russell brushed aside Anne's objections as if they were spiderwebs on his face.
"Deciding to go to Mars is like the first phrase of a sentence, and the whole sentence says,
'Wenny, weedy, weechy.'"
Russell shrugged.
"If you want to put it that way."
"You're the weenie, Sax," Anne said, lip curled with irritation. She was a broad-shouldered woman with wild brown hair, a geologist with strong views, difficult in argument.
"Look, Mars is its own place. You can play your climate-shifting games back on Earth if you want. They need the help. Or try it on Venus. But you can't just wipe out a 3-billion-year-old planetary surface."
Russell rubbed away more spiderwebs.
"It's dead," he said simply. "Besides, it's not really our decision. It'll be taken out of our hands."
"None of these decisions will be taken out of our hands," Arcadi put in sharply. Janet looked from speaker to speaker, taking it all in. Anne was getting agitated, raising her voice. Maya glanced around and saw that Frank didn't like the situation. But if he interrupted it, he would give away to the millions the fact that he didn't want the colonists arguing in front of them. Instead, he looked across the table and caught Boone's gaze. There was an exchange of expressions between the two so quick it made Maya blink. Boone said, "When I was there before, I got the impression it was already Earth-like."
"Except 200 degrees Kelvin," Russell said.
"Sure, but it looked like the Mojave or the Dry Valleys. The first time I looked around on Mars, I found myself keeping an eye out for one of those mummified seals we saw in the Dry Valleys." And so on. Janet turned to him, and Anne, looking disgusted, picked up her coffee and left. Afterward, Maya concentrated, trying to recall the looks Boone and Chalmers had exchanged. They had been like something from a code, or the private languages invented by identical twins. The weeks passed, and the days each began with a leisurely breakfast. Mid-mornings were far busier. Everyone had a schedule, although some were fuller than others. Frank's was packed, which was the way he liked it, a maniacal blur of activity. But the necessary work wasn't really all that great. They had to keep themselves alive and in shape and keep the ship running and keep preparing for Mars. Ship maintenance ranged from the intricacy of programming or repairs to the simplicity of moving supplies out of storage or taking trash to the recyclers. The biosphere team spent the bulk of its time on the farm, which occupied large parts of Taurus's C, E, and F, and everyone aboard had farm chores. Most enjoyed this work, and some even returned in their free hours. Everyone was on doctor's orders to spend 3 hours a day on treadmills, escalators, running wheels, or using weight machines. These hours were enjoyed or endured or despised, depending on temperament. But even those who claimed to despise them finished their exercises in noticeably, even measurably, better moods. "Beta endorphins are the best drug," Michel Duval would say.
"Which is lucky, since we don't have any others," John Boone would reply.
"Oh, there's caffeine. Puts me to sleep. Alcohol. Gives me a headache. Procaine, Darvon, morphine.
Morphine?
In the medical supplies, not for general use." Arcadi smiled.
"Maybe I'd better get sick."
The engineers, including Maya, spent many mornings in training simulations. These took place on the backup bridge in Taurus B, which had the latest in image synthesizers. The simulations were so sophisticated that there was little visible difference between them and the act itself. This didn't necessarily make them interesting. The standard orbital insertion approach, simulated weekly, was dubbed the Mantra Run and became quite a bore to every conceivable flight crew. But sometimes even boredom was preferable to the alternatives. Arkady was their training specialist, and he had a perverse talent for designing problem runs so hard that they often killed everybody. These runs were strangely unpleasant experiences and didn't make Arkady popular among his victims. He mixed problem runs with mantra runs randomly, but more and more often they were problem runs. They would approach Mars, and red lights would flash, sometimes with sirens, and they were in trouble again. Once, they struck a planetesimal weighing approximately 15 grams, leaving a large flaw in the heat shield. Sax Russell had calculated that their chances of hitting anything larger than a gram were about 1 in every 7,000 years of travel, but nevertheless, there they were. Emergency. Adrenaline pouring through them even as they poo-pooed the very idea of it, rushing up to the hub and into EVA suits, going out to fill the pothole before they hit the Martian atmosphere and burned to a crisp. And halfway there, Arkady's voice came over their intercoms, "Not fast enough! All of us are dead!" But that was a simple one. Others. The ship, for instance, was guided by a fly-by-wire system, meaning that the pilots fed instructions to flight computers which translated them into the actual thrusts needed to achieve the desired result. This was how it had to be, because when approaching a gravitational mass like Mars at their speed, one simply couldn't feel or intuit what burns would achieve the desired effects. So none of them were flyers in the sense of a pilot flying a plane. Nevertheless, Arkady frequently blew the entire massively redundant system just as they were reaching a critical moment, which failure, Russell said, had about a 1 in 10 billion chance of happening, and they had to take over and command all the rockets mechanically, watching the monitors and an orange-on-black visual image of Mars bearing down on them, and they could either go long and skip off into deep space and die a lingering death, or go short and crash into the planet and die instantly. And if the latter, they got to watch it right down to the simulated 120 km/s final smash. Or it might be a mechanical failure. Main rockets, stabilizing rockets, computer hardware or software, heat shield deployment, all of them had to work perfectly during the approach, and failures of these systems were the most likely of all. In the range, Sachs said, though others contested his risk assessment methods, of 1 in every 10,000 approaches. So they would do it again, and red lights would flash, and they would groan and beg for a mantra run, even as they partly welcomed the new challenge. When they managed to survive a mechanical failure, they were tremendously pleased. It could be the high point of a week. Once John Boone successfully aerobraked by hand, with a single main rocket functioning, hitting the safe millisecond of arc at the only possible speed, no one could believe it. "Blind luck," Boone said, grinning widely as the deed was talked about at dinner. Most of Arkady's problem runs ended in failure, however, meaning death for all. Simulated or not, it was hard not to be sobered by these experiences, and after that, irritated with Arkady for inventing them. One time, they repaired every monitor in the bridge just in time to see the screens register a hit by a small asteroid, which sheared through the hub and killed them all. Another time, Arkady, as part of the navigation team, made an error and instructed the computers to increase the ship's spin rather than decrease it. "Pinned to the floor by 6 G's, he cried in mock horror, and they had to crawl on the floor for half an hour, pretending to rectify the error, while weighing half a ton each. When they succeeded, Arkady leaped off the floor and began pushing them away from the control monitor. "What the hell are you doing?" Maya yelled. "He's gone crazy," Janet said. "He's simulated going crazy," Nadia corrected her. "We have to figure out," doing an end run around Arkady, "how to deal with someone on the bridge going insane." Which no doubt was true. But they could see the whites of Arkady's eyes all the way around, and there wasn't a trace of recognition in him as he silently assaulted them. It took all 5 of them to restrain him, and Janet and Phyllis Boyle were hurt by his sharp elbows. "Well," he said at dinner afterward, grinning lopsidedly as he was growing a fat lip, "what if it happens? We're under pressure up here, and the approach will be worst of all. What if someone cracks? He turned to Russell, and the grin grew wider. What are the chances of that, eh? And he began to sing a Jamaican song in a Slavic Caribbean accent.
Pressure drop, oh, pressure drop, oh-oh, pressure going to drop on you.
So they kept trying, handling the problem runs as seriously as they could. Even the attack by Martian natives, or the decoupling of Taurus H caused by explosive bolts installed by mistake when the ship was built. Or the last-minute veering of Phobos out of its orbit. Dealing with the more implausible scenarios sometimes took on a kind of surreal black humor, and Arkady replayed some of his videotapes as after-dinner entertainment, which sometimes got people launched into the air with laughter. But the plausible problem runs, they kept on coming, morning after morning. And despite the solutions, despite the protocols for finding solutions, there was that sight time after time. The red planet rushing at them at an unimaginable 40,000 kilometers an hour until it filled the screen and the screen went white and small black letters appeared on it. Collision. They were traveling to Mars in a Type 2 Hohmann ellipse, a slow but efficient course chosen from among other alternatives mainly because the two planets were in the correct position for it when the ship was finally ready, with Mars about 45 degrees ahead of Earth in the plane of the ecliptic. During the voyage, they would travel just over halfway around the sun, making their rendezvous with Mars some 300 days later. Their womb time, as Hiroko called it. The psychologists back home had judged it worthwhile to alter things from time to time, to suggest the passing of the seasons on the Aries. Length of days and nights, weather, and ambient colors were shifted to accomplish this. Some had maintained their landfall should be a harvest, others that it should be a new spring. After a short debate, it had been decided by vote of the voyagers themselves to begin with early spring, so that they would travel through a summer rather than a winter, and as they approached their goal, the ship's colors would turn to the autumn tones of Mars itself, rather than to the light greens and blossom pastels they had left so far behind. So in those first months, as they finished their morning's business, leaving the farm or the bridge or staggering out of Arkady's merrily sadistic simulations, they walked into springtime. Walls were hung with pale green panels or mural-sized photos of azaleas and jacarandas and ornamental cherries. The barley and mustard in the big farm rooms glowed vivid yellow with new blooms, and the forest biome and the ship's seven park rooms had been stocked with trees and shrubs in the spring of their cycles. Maya loved these colorful spring blossoms, and after her morning's work, she fulfilled part of her exercise regimen by taking a walk in the forest biome, which had a hilly floor and was so thick with trees one couldn't see from one end of the chamber to the other. Here she often met Frank Chalmers, of all people, taking one of his short breaks. He said he liked the spring foliage, though he never seemed to look at it. They walked together, and talked or not, as the case might be. If they did talk, it was never about anything important. Frank didn't care to discuss their work as leaders of the expedition. Maya found this peculiar, though she didn't say so. But they didn't have exactly the same jobs, which might account for his reluctance. Maya's position was fairly informal and non-hierarchical. Cosmonauts among themselves had always been relatively egalitarian. This had been the tradition since the days of Korolyov. The American program had a more military tradition, indicated even in titles. While Maya was merely Russian contingent coordinator, Frank was Captain Chalmers, and supposedly in the strong sense of the old sailing navies. Whether this authority made it more or less difficult for him, he didn't say. Sometimes he discussed the biome, or small technical problems, or news from home. More often, he just seemed to want to walk with her. So, silent walks up and down on narrow trails through dense thickets of pine and aspen and birch, and always that presumption of closeness as if they were old friends, or as if he were, very shyly or subtly, courting her. Thinking about that one day, it occurred to Maya that starting the Aries in springtime might have created a problem. Here they were in their mesocosm, sailing through spring, and everything was fertile and blooming, profligate and green, the air perfumed with flowers and windy, the days getting longer and warmer, and everyone in shirts and shorts, 100 healthy animals in close quarters, eating, exercising, showering, sleeping. Of course, there had to be sex. Well, it was nothing new. Maya herself had had some fantastic sex in space, most significantly during her second stint on Novi Mir, when she and Georgi and Yeli and Irina had tried every weightless variant imaginable, which was a great many indeed. But now it was different. They were older. They were stuck with each other for good. Everything is different in a closed system, as Hiroko often said in other contexts. The idea that they should stay on a fraternal basis was big at NASA. Out of the 1,348 pages of the tome NASA had compiled called Human Relations in Transit to Mars, only a single page was devoted to the subject of sex, and that page advised against it. They were, the tome suggested, something like a tribe with a sensible taboo against intra-tribal mating. The Russians laughed hilariously at this. Americans were such prudes, really. "We are not a tribe," Arkady said. "We are the world." And it was spring, and there were the married couples aboard, some of whom were pretty demonstrative. And there was the swimming pool in Taurus E, and the sauna and whirlpool bath. Bathing suits were used in mixed company, this because of the Americans again, but bathing suits were nothing. Naturally, it began to happen. She heard from Nadia and Ivana that the bubble dome was being used for assignations in the quiet hours of the night. Many of the cosmonauts and astronauts turned out to be fond of weightlessness, and the many nooks in the parks and the forest biome were serving as hideaways for those with less weightless experience. The parks had been designed to give people the sense that they could get away, and every person had a private soundproofed room of their own. With all that, if a couple wanted to begin a relationship without becoming an item in the gossip mill, it was possible to be very discreet. Maya was sure there was more going on than any one person could know. She could feel it. No doubt others did as well. Quiet conversations between couples, changes in dining room partners, quick glances, small smiles, hands touching shoulders or elbows in passing. Oh yes, things were happening. It made for a kind of tension in the air, a tension that was only partly pleasant. Antarctic fears came back into play, and besides, there was only a small number of potential partners, which tended to give things a musical chairs kind of feeling. And for Maya, there were additional problems. She was even more wary than usual of Russian men, because in this case it would mean sleeping with the boss. She was suspicious of that, knowing how it had felt when she had done it herself. Besides, none of them... Well, she was attracted to Arkady, but she didn't like him, and he seemed uninterested. Yeli, she knew from before, he was just a friend. Dmitri, she didn't care for. Vlad was older, Yuri not her type, Alex a follower of Arkady's, on and on like that. And as for the Americans, or the internationals, well, that was a different kind of problem. Cross cultures, who knew? So she kept to herself. But she thought about it. And occasionally, while waking up in the morning or finishing a workout, she floated on a wave of desire that left her washed up on the shore of bed or shower, feeling alone. Thus, late one morning, after a particularly harrowing problem run, which they had almost solved and then failed to solve, she ran into Frank Chalmers in the forest biome and returned his hello. and they walked for about 10 meters into the woods and stopped. She was in shorts and tank top, barefoot, sweaty, and flushed from the crazed simulation. He was in shorts and a t-shirt, barefoot, sweaty, and dusty from the farm. Suddenly he laughed his sharp laugh and reached out to touch her upper arm with 2 fingertips. "You're looking happy today," with that darting smile. The leaders of the 2 halves of the expedition, equals. She lifted her hand to touch his, and that was all it took. They left the trail and ducked into a tight thicket of pine. They stopped to kiss, and it had been long enough since the last time that it felt strange to her. Tripping over a root, Frank laughed under his breath, that quick, secretive laugh which gave Maya a shiver, almost of fear. They sat on pine needles, rolled together like students necking in the woods. She laughed. She had always liked the quick approach, the way she could just knock a man down when she wanted to. And so they made love, and for a time passion took her away. When it was over, she relaxed, enjoying the wash of afterglow. But then it got a bit awkward somehow. She didn't know what to say. There was something hidden still about him, as if he were hiding even when making love. And even worse, what she could sense behind his reserve was some kind of triumph, as if he had won something and she had lost. That Puritan streak in Americans, that sense that sex was wrong and something that men had to trick women into. She closed up a little herself, annoyed at that hidden smirk on his face. Win and lose. What children. And yet they were co-mayors, so to speak. So if it were put on a zero-sum basis... They talked for a while in a jovial enough way, and even made love again before they left, but it wasn't quite the same as the first time. She found herself distracted. So much in sex was beyond rational analysis. Maya always felt things about her partners that she couldn't analyze or even express, but she always either liked what she felt or didn't. There was no doubt about that. And looking at Frank Chalmers's face after the first time, she had been sure that something wasn't right. It made her uneasy. But she was amiable, affectionate. It wouldn't do to be put off at such a moment. No one would forgive that. They got up and dressed and went back into Taurus D and ate dinner at the same table with some others, and that was when it made perfect sense to become more distant. But then in the days after their encounter, she was surprised and displeased to find herself putting him off a little bit, making excuses to avoid being alone with him. It was awkward, not what she had wanted at all. She would have preferred not to feel the way she did. And once or twice after that, they went off alone again, and when he started things, she made love with him again, wanting it to work, feeling that she must have made a mistake or been in a bad mood somehow. But it was always the same. There was always that little smirk of triumph, that "I got you" that she disliked so much, that moralistic Puritan double-standard dirtiness. And so she avoided him even more, to keep from getting into the start situation, and quickly enough, he caught the drift. One afternoon he asked her to go for a walk in the biome, and when she declined, claiming fatigue, a staccato look of surprise passed over his face, and then it had closed up like a mask. She felt badly, because she couldn't even explain it to herself. To try to make up for such an unreasonable withdrawal, she was friendly and forthright with him after that, as long as it was a safe situation. And once or twice, she suggested indirectly that for her their encounters had been only a matter of sealing a friendship, something she had done with others as well. All this had to be conveyed between words, however, and it was possible he misunderstood. After that first jolt of comprehension, he only seemed puzzled. Once, when she left the group just before it broke up, she had seen him give her a sharp glance. After that, only distance and reserve. But he had never been really upset, and he never pressed the issue or came to her to talk about it. But that was part of the problem, wasn't it? He didn't seem to want to talk to her about that kind of thing. Well, perhaps he had affairs going with other women, with some of the Americans. It was hard to say. He really did keep to himself, but it was awkward. Maya resolved to abolish the knockover seduction, no matter the thrill she got from it. Hiroko was right. Everything was different in a closed system. It was too bad for Frank, if he did care, because he had served as her education in this regard. In the end, she resolved to make it up to him by being a good friend. She worked so hard at doing this that once, almost a month later, she miscalculated and went a little too far, to the point where he thought she was seducing him again. They had been part of a group, up late talking, and she had sat next to him, and afterward he had clearly gotten the wrong impression and walked with her around Taurus D to the bathrooms, talking in the charming and affable way he had at this stage of things. Maya was vexed with herself. She didn't want to seem completely fickle, although at this point, either way she went, it would probably look that way. So she went along with him just because it was easier, and because there was a part of her that wanted to make love. And so she did, upset with herself, and resolved that this should be the last time. A sort of final gift that would hopefully make the whole incident a good memory for him. She found herself becoming more passionate than ever before. She really wanted to please him. And then, just before orgasm, she looked up at his face, and it was like looking in the windows of an empty house. That was the last time. Delta V for velocity, delta for change. In space, this is the measure of the change in velocity required to get from one place to another, thus a measure of the energy required to do it. Everything is moving already, but to get something from the moving surface of the Earth into orbit around it requires a minimum delta V of 10 kilometers per second. To leave Earth's orbit and fly to Mars requires a minimum delta V of 3.6 kilometers per second. And to orbit Mars and land on it requires a delta V of about 1 kilometer per second. The hardest part is leaving Earth behind, for that is by far the deepest gravity well involved. Climbing up that steep curve of space-time takes tremendous force, shifting the direction of an enormous inertia. History, too, has an inertia. In the four dimensions of space-time, particles, or events, have directionality. Mathematicians trying to show this draw what they call world lines on graphs. In human affairs, individual world lines form a thick tangle, curling out of the darkness of prehistory and stretching through time. A cable the size of Earth itself, spiraling round the sun on a long, curved course. That cable of tangled world lines is history. Seeing where it has been, it's clear where it's going. It's a matter of simple extrapolation. For what kind of delta V would it take to escape history? To escape an inertia that powerful and carve a new course? The hardest part is leaving Earth behind. The form of the Ares gave a structure to reality. The vacuum between Earth and Mars began to seem to Maya like a long series of cylinders bent up at their joints at 45-degree angles. There was a runner's course, a kind of steeplechase around Taurus C, and at each joint she slowed down in her run and tensed her legs for the increased pressure of the two 22.5-degree bends, and suddenly she could see up the length of the next cylinder. It was beginning to seem a rather narrow world. Perhaps in compensation, the people inside began to get somehow larger. The process of shedding their Antarctic masks continued, and every time someone displayed some new and hitherto unknown characteristic, it made all who noticed it feel that much freer, and this feeling caused more hidden traits to be revealed. One Sunday morning, the Christians aboard, numbering a dozen or so, celebrated Easter in the bubble dome. It was April back home, though the Aries season was midsummer. After their service, they came down to the D dining hall for brunch, among them Yuri, Raya, Edvard, and Mary. Maya, Frank, John, Arkady, and Sax were at a table, drinking cups of coffee and tea. The conversations among them and with other tables were densely interwoven, and at first only Maya and Frank heard what John was saying to Phyllis Boyle, the geologist, who had conducted the Easter service. "I understand the idea of the universe as a super-being, and all its energy being the thoughts of this being. It's a nice concept. But the Christ story..." John shook his head. "Do you really know the story?" Phyllis asked. "I was brought up Lutheran in Minnesota," John replied shortly. "I went to confirmation classes, had the whole thing drilled into me." Which, Maya thought, was probably why he bothered to get into discussions like this. He had a displeased expression that Maya had never seen before, and she leaned forward a bit, suddenly concentrating. She glanced at Frank. He was gazing into his coffee cup as if in a reverie, but she was sure he was listening. John said, "You must know that the Gospels were written decades after the event, by people who never met Christ, and that there are other Gospels which reveal a different Christ, Gospels that were excluded from the Bible by a political process in the 3rd century. So he's a kind of literary figure, really, a political construct. We don't know anything about the man himself." Phyllis shook her head. "That's not true." "But it is," John objected. This caused Sax and Arkady to look up from the next table. "Look, there's a history to all this stuff. Monotheism is a belief system that you see appearing in early herding societies. The greater their dependence on sheep herding, the more likely their belief in a shepherd god. It's an exact correlation. You can chart it and see. And the god is always male because those societies were patriarchal. There's a kind of archaeology, an anthropology, a sociology of religion that makes all of this perfectly clear. How it came about, what needs it fulfilled." Phyllis regarded him with a small smile. "I don't know what to say to that, John. It's not a matter of history, after all. It's a matter of faith." "Do you believe in Christ's miracles?" "The miracles aren't what matter. It's not the church or its dogma that matters. It's Jesus himself that matters." "But he's just a literary construct," John repeated doggedly. "Something like Sherlock Holmes or the Lone Ranger. And you didn't answer my question about the miracles." Phyllis shrugged. "I consider the presence of the universe to be a miracle. The universe and everything in it. Can you deny it?" "Sure," John said. "The universe just is. I define a miracle as an action that clearly breaks known physical law. Like traveling to other planets?" "No, like raising the dead. Doctors do that every day." "Doctors have never done that." Phyllis looked nonplussed. "I don't know what to say to you, John. I'm kind of surprised. We don't know everything. To pretend we do is arrogance. The creation is mysterious. To give something a name like the Big Bang and then think you have an explanation, it's bad logic, bad thinking. Outside your rational scientific thought is an enormous area of consciousness, an area more important than science. Faith in God is part of that, and I suppose you either have it or you don't." She stood. "I hope it comes to you." She left the room. After a silence, John sighed. "Sorry, folks. Sometimes it still gets to me." "Whenever scientists say they're Christian," Sax said, "I take it to be an aesthetic statement." "The church of the wouldn't it be pretty to think so," Frank said, still looking into his cup. Sax said, "They feel we're missing a spiritual dimension of life that earlier generations had, and they attempt to regain it using the same means." He blinked in his owlish way, as if the problem were disposed of by being defined. "But that brings in so many absurdities," John exclaimed. "You just don't have faith," Frank said, egging him on. John ignored him. "People who in the lab are as hard-headed as can be. You should see Phyllis grilling the conclusions her colleagues draw from their data. and then suddenly they start using all kinds of debaters' tricks, evasions, qualifications, fuzzy thinking of every kind, as if they were an entirely different person.
You just don't have faith, Frank repeated.
Well, I hope I never get it. It's like being hit by a hammer in the head.
John stood and took his tray to the kitchen. The rest looked at each other in silence. It must have been, Maya thought, a really bad confirmation class. Clearly, none of the others had known any more than her about this side of their easygoing hero. Who knew what they would learn next about him or any of them?